What are your feelings on Jaeger? Okay, what are your feelings on mezcal?
Yes, there we go. Now we're talking.
Right? We like the smokiness in mezcal.
Love it.
But we don't like the anise in Jaeger, right? That's what you don't, that's probably what you don't like, that licorice note?
That's it. The black licorice, that just doesn't.
All right.
I can't.
What if I told you that if I blended equal parts dry curacao, Jaeger, and mezcal, that the smokiness of mezcal would overwhelm, would cover up the licorice black notes licorice in the Jaeger?
It sounds like you've done this before.
I have. I told you I could do that, shake it with an egg white, a little bit of lemon juice to keep it sweet. And that you had a really, really fun smoky cocktail.
That sounds awesome.
I call it the Zimmerman Telegram, to be offensive, but
did you know that over $5 trillion exchanges hands on a daily basis? That's an average of over $220 billion an hour. Now, how does this much money move every single day, and why does it move the way it does? Here on Drunkenomics, two bartenders who also happen to be students at the University of Nebraska Graduate School of Business are going to sit down and drink to the global economy and try and translate it into English. So sit back, relax, pour yourself a stiff one, and have a drink with us to the comedy that is the global economy.
All right, everybody, and welcome back to yet another episode, yet another presentation of Drunkenomics. This is the drinking podcast with an economics problem. And toast to James real quick, because last week you said, I remember, the only gym you go to is Jim Beam. And here I am drinking a Jim Beam Double Oak to honor the remarks that you made last week. So cheers to that. Hopefully you also have a stiff one in front of you as well.
I do. I have a fine glass of boxed wine.
Oh, that sounds almost as good as this Jim Beam.
Well, I bought it to make New York sours, and we're really running up on that 30-day deadline, and I hate to waste.
No, yeah, you got it. I mean, dude, you know what to do. Fill and kill, all right?
Absolutely.
So with that said, thank you so much for joining us. Seriously, I hope you do have a nice stiff one in front of you, unless, of course, you're about to drive somewhere. In that case, wait till your destination, and then drink responsibly. But seriously, can't thank you enough for joining along with us. Hopefully you had a nice week off, you were able to recover from your hangover,
because obviously you were celebrating 3 years just as hard as we were.
Yeah, exactly. So it took me a while, but I think I'm clear from the repercussions of all the drinking I've done in the last 3 years after the week I had off.
Oh, I'm absolutely not. But then again, as some of the guys I used to live with used to say, is you can't be hungover if you keep drinking. Now, that's not health advice. This is not energy performance. It's just, if you run from the hangover, it's going to get worse.
But it really will.
It's going to catch you first.
But all I'm saying is, I mean, you know, play chestnut checkers, okay? I mean,
absolutely.
If you need to, you
need to. Whatever that means to you.
Yes, exactly.
As long as it's legal.
Yeah, not health advice. And while we're on that, nothing we say is financial advice either. This is just, you know, we're drinking. We're just kind of venting about the economics problems.
And enjoying a drink. And enjoying a stiff drink on whatever day of the week we're recording. In this case, a Monday.
Exactly.
But there's a lot of problems out there. And frankly, you know, they say you should talk about... What was it? I read a very interesting article several years ago, and it said that a night out at the pub with friends has the same effect to an extent of going to therapy.
You know what?
And that you talk about things. Aaron and I, we look at the economic markets, we look at the economies of the world, and frankly, it's led us to need therapy.
No, 100%.
So thanks for being here.
Yeah, seriously. So thanks for being our sounding board. Thanks for being our therapist, everybody. And seriously, I mean, I don't even know if that study is true. I'm not even going to look into it to dispute it, because I want it to be true.
You know, I want it to be true so bad that I'm gonna do that to get my weekly night in the pub with mates, and
there we go.
The best.
Yeah. So thank you, blokes, for joining us. What should we say? What was your name again? You're less gracious, aren't you, this week?
I think so. I don't think
I mean, the VIX is sub 19, just so you know.
Wait a minute. What?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, I'm less gracious. That's right.
Yeah.
The market's doing well, so I'm less gracious. And the market's not doing well, then I get to be gracious because I was right about something.
Well, okay, just...
Or totally wrong and just went with it. Who knows? So I am James Goldwater, less gracious host, as I have been, I think, all year.
Yeah, I think, because the Eagles didn't win the Super Bowl, the Pigeons didn't win the Super Bowl, and
I don't know,
did you win any other?
Yeah, but I think I won bets to stay less gracious.
Well, do you have another bet idea? I'll give you
I lost the bet with I lost the Kansas City.
Yeah, the Pigeons.
I lost the Kansas City Bengals bet.
Oh, that too. That's right.
Which was some.
Yeah. Okay. I 100% agree. But also, I'll say this. So S&P was up today, mm-hmm. right? This is Monday. What day is it? March 6th. So Monday 3/6.
This is a big week for news, though. We've got CPI coming out this week. We got Fed. We got a Fed tomorrow. A Fed meeting tomorrow.
So I think I saw something on the news earlier, and it was like this week is Fed week. Next week is inflation. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait. No, jobs report also comes out this week, too.
That's right. Jobs report is... Yeah.
So that's going to be...
Wednesday, March 8th.
Wednesday, March 8th?
Jobs opening labor... The JOLTS survey.
Friday,
March 10th at 8:30, the employment situation for February. So we get JOLTS for January and February. And then February jobs.
That's going to be paramount because I think what we saw in the last jobs report was just a resoundingly yes, this soft landing is potentially what kills me is that
report doesn't even say there's a landing. That report suggests that we haven't fallen off. We're still climbing. Not climbing, but you know that we still haven't peaked yet. And then I know that the Fed looked at the Fed's one of their preferred CPI indicating indexes, indices.
Yeah, the PCE.
PCE came in really hot. So
it really goes to show. I mean, and this is the thing, like everybody has been going like, well, you know, is it going to be a soft landing? Is it going to be a hard landing? What kind of, you know, I honestly felt like the fact that we're still asking this question of whether or not there's going to be a hard landing or a soft landing is already a bad thing.
Can I ask a really silly question? Sure. I realize we may have moved past this, but I'm the less gracious host, which makes you the more gracious host. But that also makes you.
Oh, yeah. That makes
me. Does that make you like Aaron Soft Landing Wong?
That makes me Aaron Soft Landing Wong. No, I want to be. Oh, no. I guess no. You're definitely James Hard Landing Goldwater. No. And I'm Aaron
Soft.
No,
I'm James Belly Flop Goldwater. James
Crash Landing Belly Flop Goldwater.
To call it out, what I'll say is this. My view about what I'm seeing. And the worst part is like a lot of the stuff I'm seeing, a lot of the indicators I'm seeing is it leads to this feeling. And I hate the idea that I'm using a feeling.
Yeah.
But to me, to call it a landing is that's a strong misuse of the word. It will collide with the ground. it's one of those things where it's like, is it a landing? Technically.
Well, so this is the thing. This is the reason why I said what I said about the fact that we're still asking, you know, are we going to have a hard landing or are we going to have a soft landing? The reason why I think that's a bad thing is because we're still technically in this quote unquote economically unstable environment. We're still in that environment. Oh,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
We can all agree with that, right? So
we can.
You know, if you had just pulled the Band-Aid off and said, all right, hard landing. Let's get it over with. Let's get the recession over with. Let's move on with our lives.
Yeah.
And I don't like recessions, right? It's not, you know, I'm not saying like, you know, I'm not rooting for
like
a recession.
I like corrections. Recessions I have problems with. I agree. Yeah. I would agree with you.
Yeah. And even corrections corrections can be harsh too, but sometimes they're necessary, right? But recessions,
always necessary.
Yeah. Because if everything's running hot, if everything's overvalued, there needs to be a correction. Right. If it just doesn't make sense.
You need to take a breath.
If everything is trading at 24 times forward earnings, there needs to be a correction.
There's a reason that really great night out has a hangover the next day often. Yeah. There's a reason that.
Exactly. Everything in moderation, even for the economy. Right. So that's why I feel like, you know, the QT, first of all, QE lasted way too long. You got to be kidding me with that.
Way too long.
At some point, they should have just been. Yeah. If they were really data dependent or whatever they claimed them to be, or whatever their high horse is. They made a lot of claims. If they really were data dependent, they should have been like, all right, no more QE, right? The tapering took forever. And they kept pushing they kept kicking the can down the road. And then on top of that, QT is this like incredibly, it's still too little. It's way too, I'm actually seeing what you've been saying. You've been saying this longer than I have. So I'm coming to terms with you, James. You were right.
I like being right.
When you're right too.
There's always that one movie where like there's the most pessimistic character in the group, like the old grizzled person that's like, I hate being right all the time. I don't.
No.
I love it.
Honestly,
that's not true. There are times where I'm like, when
you're Grim Reaper,
I know
level,
this ends badly, but we're in it to win it now.
Yeah.
And I've kind of taken to heart as very much empirical for me. And I think for you too, Aaron, is I love learning, but I hate being taught.
I'm with you on that. Like, gosh, it's so weird. Like, I hate it when people talk to me like I don't know anything.
Because most important lessons that we take to heart are learned in pain, like learned through pain and suffering. Right. They're not. Well, like,
that's the thing. It's like, I hate it when people talk to me like I don't know anything, but like it makes sense for them to do that because in the grand scheme of things, I really don't know anything.
Well, I know what was it? One of the Romans said, "Failure is the best teacher."
That's a good point. Like, yeah, but that's what I'm saying. It's like I'm with you though. Like I really think if they just went from zero, maybe not. Maybe if they went from 0 basis points to 200 basis points to 400 basis points. Sounds like I'm making a cocktail, but like, you know, like
it all depends on what you're mixing.
Yeah. Hey man, so for this Manhattan,
all right, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take that empty glass. I want you to put 200 basis points of scotch in, and then I want you to put 200 more basis points of scotch in, and then give me 3 cubes of ice.
And that's it.
And you're done.
I call that a drunken arms double. 400 basis points of scotch. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. That's from now on. Exactly. That's how we're measuring our cocktails. We're measuring them in basis points, but
exactly. And that should be taken every Friday at market close until symptoms.
Yeah.
Until symptoms disappear.
That's a deal. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing is I really think the Fed ripping the bandaid off. Cause I remember you said that and I was like, oh, I don't know if they should just rip the bandaid off. Cause I don't know if that could be catastrophic or not.
It could have been.
Yeah, it could have been.
Right. We have the luxury of looking back and going, it could have been worse.
I know, but like right now, I feel like we just got shot in the gut and we're bleeding out, right? Instead of just like, you know, like,
yeah,
that's what it feels like. Because this is we're still talking about a soft landing. It's like okay, we're still nowhere near stability. We're nowhere, right?
No.
So
no. It's at this point. I'd say like we're talking about you've seen Band of Brothers.
A few episodes, yeah.
At this point, we're talking about a soft landing, but it's the night jump in Normandy. It's like you don't necessarily know where the ground is. And we're talking about a soft landing, and it's like, really?
So using your analogy, it's possible.
Yeah, in theory.
In theory, yeah, totally.
But you could just as easily belly flop into a flooded field, which did happen that night.
Yeah.
In the Germans flooded fields.
Yeah. I mean, we'll at least get to pick his brain a little bit because this week it's also, you know, he's got a presser tomorrow and a presser on
exactly
what do you call that thing saying?
This is, I mean, it's Fed week, so
yeah, it is.
We have a Fed presser Tuesday, so tomorrow.
I think does it go to Wednesday too?
I believe it does.
Okay,
and then we also have the JOLTS report on Tuesday. The JOLTS report for January on Tuesday. We have the jobs report on Thursday from February. What mm-hmm. else? What's Wednesday?
Well, CPI is next Tuesday.
CPI is next.
Oh, and the beige book comes out on Wednesday. Which, to be honest with you,
that's what Wednesday was. Yeah,
I've read like the last 6 beige books. There's no takeaways, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I don't know who's writing this, but it's very dry.
It's extremely dry. It's drier than the Sahara Desert, and also. It's just, you know, like it's got more mixed signals than a Tinder date. You know, it's just, it's bad.
Hell,
it's,
don't even wait for the date. Just look at the profile.
Just look at, yeah, exactly.
You're wearing a bikini the whole time, but you're looking for something serious. I'm very confused.
Yeah. And, you know, and then on the flip side, there's a guy flexing in the gym and all that kind of stuff. And then he's like, I'm very down to earth. Okay.
And I like a good conversation.
Totally.
Like, come on now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I see what you did to that fish.
Dude, see, that's what I mean. Right. So that's the beige book. That's exactly what it is. It's the Tinder profile
from someone that isn't being honest with themselves or anyone else.
Exactly. You know, it's really, I mean, you should really just be introspective if you were the Fed and whatever. I don't want to get too philosophical on this thing, but yeah, that comes out and then CPI comes out next week. I mean, the beginning of every month is always, now it's like everybody's sitting at the edge of their chairs at the beginning of every month going like, okay, I paid my rent. Now let's look at CPI.
Let's see how bad it can get.
Let's look at the jobs numbers.
Let me just tell you this. It could always get worse.
Mm-hmm. Touche, my man. Touche. So about the Fed presser,
mm-hmm.
I think we're going to get just extreme hawkish tone. I don't know about you.
It's definitely bird season. It's definitely dove season. I think it has to be like hunting doves, like dove season.
Oh, that kind of stuff. Okay. I was like, what are you talking about here?
No, if it is not popular to be a dove, the one of the big doves in the
is
Fed
gone. Is not in the Fed anymore.
He's gone now. So Leo Brainer, she's off to the National Economic Council. And, for good or ill. I disagree with her about being a dove, but I like.
Well, I mean, like, I feel like if you're always going to be a dove,
I feel like just, if you're a dove, you're right 80% of the time.
Yeah,
but the 20% of the time you're wrong. you are so wrong.
You are seriously like
that. It invalidates the other 80. It's like
no, it's I mean, honestly, like you know, a happy trails to Lael Brainer. I don't wish. I don't have any ill wishes on any members of the Fed. The Fed is like they've been super unpopular members of society lately, and it makes sense. I mean, I feel like
I get it. It's fair.
I get it. You know, I don't want to be too hard on them because I feel like their job is hard enough. But you know, if you want to talk about why they even have
they
jobs,
would listen to
different story.
It'd be easier if they listened to us and they were right.
Yeah, no, 100%. But I just think it's just gonna be just pure hawkish tone because I don't know of anything that came out in February.
They were too dovish in January, is my view, and without reason, without cause, and then. We're now in March, and I think they have to, if they're data driven, if they're going to say we need to get control of inflation, we need to get control of these things, then they need to get control of these things. They can't sit here and be like, well, we saw this one precursor.
Yes. Either way, you know, I think there just has been anything that I've seen that would make Jerome Powell's pressers
in
the next two, and we'll see because we don't know who's. Speaking down his neck, right? Like
here's. Did you watch that 70s show ever? And I guess this is maybe my one callback to a show.
I love that 70s show.
All right. So you remember the one episode where it's like I think it's in the first season, but where the gang's in the basement and Lori comes down and Lori's like
that's Eric's mom, right?
It's Eric's sister.
Oh yeah.
And Lori's
like
he's talking to Kelso, and Kelso's like. She so wants me.
Yeah.
And Hyde looks at him and just goes, what room were you in?
Did you not hear?
And he's like, you didn't hear that? Yeah, and then it's the clip of her just being like, I want you, Kelso. And it's very clearly just him selectively, an edited
version in his own head, just like a completely edited dialogue.
The only thing I can read to the Fed lower at being dovish like they've been so far this year is that it's very much them cherry picking the data and going, and we even said it at the time. It's like the next day that actual data came out and it's like,
So I'll say this. So
what were you thinking?
100%. Like, I think, the 25 basis points that, I mean, I don't know. Like, what do you like? I think there were two kind of aspects to that. The 25 basis points, which was the interest expense was about $1 trillion, all due to, you know, I don't know what you call the opposite of reinvestment risk. Like if you're a bond investor, what do you call the opposite of that? Like, don't look it up. This is the opposite of that.
Plowback, which is when you go right back into it.
Right. But I'm saying, like, if you're the issuer,
I guess it's divesting.
Okay.
I'm divesting.
So yeah. So whatever it is. I mean, I'm saying, like, if you're as the issuer, right? So now you're reissuing new bonds that just expired at higher interest rates. I forget what it's called. I mean, I don't think too hard about it, but like it's called
a kick in the nuts.
that's exactly what it is. If we want to start sounding like the Bee Gees, but like they literally they're staring down like the barrel of a loaded gun of almost $1 trillion worth of interest expense. So I think there was that pressure kind of pushing down on them there. But even then, the bond markets, and this is just as of today, they're pricing in about a 100 point. They're pricing in about a 100 basis point rate hike up until I think July. So we'll see.
Okay.
I hope they're right. I don't know how they're doing it.
I hope they are too.
Yeah, I don't know how they're doing it. Someone just said that, so I'm really just stealing that from somebody else. It's not like I looked at the bond prices and was like, oh, that means, you know, no, I don't know.
It would make more sense. But that's Fed week. That's this data. I mean, like, there's been some other pretty wild data too. Because I mean,
well, it sounds really scary, right? It just sounds pretty doomy.
Well, but if you want other like doomy stuff, there's like, so I wrote a very interesting article this morning that was suggesting that I think it wasn't even in The Economist, but the likelihood of Beijing attempting a military intervention in Taiwan is higher now than ever before. That there's essentially a timetable at which point they can't do it anymore. And apparently, more importantly and more concerningly to me, is that the Taiwanese people aren't necessarily certain about how they should respond to that. My response is, well, resist always, because
it's going to be a little bit tougher for Taiwan, though.
Well, I know, and you're absolutely right. And I realize that, like, it's saying that it's that I'm saying resist from the comfort of my basement several thousand miles away. Like, it's very, very easy for me to say that. It's
right.
You know, but more than that, I was looking at it was the Chinese demographic data. That mainland China is looking at. Well, we discussed the other day that they have actual not economic, but they have actual population decline, and that's not, it's not a one-off.
No, yeah.
It's legitimate shrinkage.
Yeah, and this is the thing is, like, I feel like countries that can get away with a decreasing population are countries like the USA, where there are plenty of people lined up trying to get into the USA. Into the U.S. I don't know. I keep saying the U.S.A.
Well, I don't, but I'm not convinced the United States. So the United, when we say like the United States has a declining population, and well, one, we don't say that because I don't say that.
Yeah, well, it's not.
The United States does not have a declining population. The United States is well above the replacement rate.
Right. Now, yeah, but that's the thing. It's like, you know, and even if we did, it's like there are plenty of people knocking at the door trying to get in. Two,
absolutely.
We, you know, and I'm just speaking purely logistically.
There's a huge immigration.
Yeah, inflows, right? And two, we have a ton of automation and we have the technology to implement more and to invest more in automation if all of a sudden we just don't have enough, you know, manual labor to fill those roles.
And to be fair, I mean, the funny thing is, as we say this, like, we currently don't have enough labor to fill the roles. And it's led to a certain amount of the inflation that we're currently facing and feeling. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
But
over in China, it's a different story, right? Like,
it's going to be worse because here in the US right now, it's still, 62% workforce participation? Well, yeah. Workforce participation?
Participation.
I'm not slurring my words.
Blame the wine.
I am a little bit.
blame the holy water.
Why?
Yeah, but like here we have a net positive immigration rate, right? Like not emigration,
absolutely.
Immigration, right? So immigration, not E immigration.
Yeah, immigration coming in, emigration exiting, yeah. Right? So I versus E, inner exit.
Yeah.
Easiest way to describe it.
Exactly. So if you look over in China, opposite story that we're seeing.
Absolutely.
Obviously, if you're in China,
yeah. Like, if you have the ability, if you have the means to leave mainland China and go somewhere better,
they are literally,
it happens.
China's literally begging everybody. Like, if you leave, like, they're like, when are you coming back? Like,
yeah.
You
can't take your money.
Yeah.
Let's put it this way: you cannot take your wealth out of China, which is why. So we've discussed historically that you can't, that investing in China is a bad idea unless you're going through Hong Kong, where you can pull your money out of Hong Kong, right?
If
you put your money straight into China, you can't take all of it out. And that's a Chinese mechanism to, one, keep external money there, and two, to keep internal money there, because it's really, really hard to go live overseas without money.
I'll say this, like, just a quick touch up on the investing in China.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think China's investable.
I agree.
I think
that's before apparently the Biden administration is considering new restrictions.
Right. Yeah. But okay. So this is the thing. I don't think China's investable. It is certainly tradable if you know what you're doing. So I'll say that and I'll leave right there. But yeah, I don't think China's investable. Not necessarily because of the everybody thinks China's uninvestable because of the sanctions. If they invade Taiwan and they sanction that we're not going to sanction.
Well, yeah, sure, but that's not the main. That would be like a new reason not to.
That would be a thing that might happen.
But
if we sanction,
looking at the demographics, is a good enough reason not to.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I was going to say. Is like, if we sanction China, like we sanctioned Russia, that would be like the worst. If there ever was a doom cycle or a doom loop, that would be the worst connecting point of the doom loop, was if we sanction China like we sanction Russia, to be honest with you. But restrictions, I see certainly possibility. But like I said, I think China's investable, not because of that, not because of the sanctions that could possibly be imposed in China. It's more so just because, all right, if all of a sudden, like, they release their true demographic data, and then we see that their average age is 48.8,
Which entertainingly, so this is the funny thing. The average migrant laborer is 42 years old in China.
No kidding. So I was
going from 48.8
was
far off.
It was a complete guess.
So the average migrant laborer who leaves the country to go to the city to work is 42 years old now. That is up from 34 in 2012.
Yeah. So what we're seeing here, like, in basically translation in terms of economic,
they're aging fast.
Yeah. In terms of, it's rapid. That's insanely fast. But in just a translation in terms of like economic implications, that means most of the workforce now, if the average age is 42, most of the workforce is probably not going to be a part of the workforce in 25 years.
Absolutely.
Right.
In fact, I was digging into it. Do you know what the retirement age is for women in China?
I don't, but I'm curious now. That's really
fascinating. It's 55. Do you know what it is if she works in a factory and doing manual labor?
I have no idea.
50.
Oh, wow.
Do you know what it is for men, no matter what?
60.
Wow. Wow. In the United States, do you know what the retirement age is?
60.
I know you do, but.
8 now?
I 65. Forget. 60. 60 no, 65.
When were they going to. I thought they were going to move it up.
Consider it. Well, here's the thing. 65 is the standard retirement age.
Right.
And I think that's given the quality of living, the quality of life expectancies, that's quite young.
I agree. Yeah.
But in China,
I mean, I wouldn't be opposed if they never raise it. I would not be opposed if they never raise the 65 limit. Just me, selfishly.
Well, there are pros and cons, and I could find myself arguing either side.
Exactly. No, there are definitely pros and cons. I just want to level with everybody that's drinking with me. That 65, okay.
I'll say 65 seems fine.
40 years. 40 years.
What I will say is, if in China it's 15 years before that for women at manual labor, 10 years before that for women that aren't at manual labor, and 5 years before that for all men, and that China has actually a large number of people. I was looking at the demographics. And the age groups that live in fact, you have to get above the age of 65 before there are more women than men in China. Fun fact. So I guess on the plus side, you don't have to pay men pensions for more than 5 years, really, from when they stop working.
Yeah.
But for women, in some of these cases, if they were working, it might be 20, 30 years that you're paying them a pension out. There's a point where in about 30 years, there's an expectation that, I know that by the end of this century, there's an argument that for every 100 people working in China, there'll be at least 120 people retired, not including children, but 120 retired.
Wow.
That you're supporting.
Right now,
100 workers support 20.
So what's the workforce participation rate there now, or what's it projected to be? Do you know?
Well, at that point, I want to say that the workforce participation in China would be something, it'd be below 50%.
Whoa. What?
Yeah, because right now, 68.3% of China's has 68.3% workforce participation, or at least not participation, but that's the amount of people, or that's the percentage of the population that is over 15, under 65. Now, here's the funny thing. Why 65? Because that's what the West uses as a number. Not what China uses.
So I feel like it's even more skewed that way then.
Yeah.
I think
the math I did said it would be a 48%. The math I did said that in the worst case scenario, or at least the trend, the math says right now that there will be a point within 50 years where 48% of China is old enough to work.
Oh, no.
And the rest of it is either too old or too young.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm seeing that too, because I remember you sent me that a while ago. I think I sent you that text.
And I was just, yeah, it's 46. I did the math and I went, shit, I need someone to know that.
Is it 46%? 46%?
46. It is 46.
Yeah, that's, it is, God, 46. That's, so like we complain about a 62% like workforce participation, which I don't think is good, but like over there, I mean.
Well, with automation, like, I mean, you and I both argue, and economically in the U.S., we'd argue that we need more people participating to bring inflation into check, which is a really funny thing to say, which is to say we actually need more people working to bring inflation down. And the only way that works is that it's more people doing tasks that then lower the cost of that task.
Yeah,
essentially, it lowers 100%. The cost of doing that work more than the cost of paying them to do it, right? So it's a very strange thing. It's like, I'll pay more people to work so that I can pay less for the work to get done.
Yeah.
Extremely counterintuitive.
Exactly. But like, so shifting gears back over to China, like, so they have a serious issue in the sense that one, the workforce participation is at 46%. And it's declining.
Or will be.
Yeah, will be pretty
will
soon.
Be.
And it's probably going to get even worse from there.
Well, it won't get better.
Because
it's this really interesting point of like, people right now in China are saying, I only want to have one child. Like, so they had the one child policy for a very long time. And then they got rid of the one child policy. They said, have two kids. Because they realized, well,
that was probably bad.
We're running out of cheap labor. There's a reason Vietnam. I'm sorry. Chinese labor costs twice as much as Vietnamese labor right now.
Because of that, but it's also
there's a few factors.
There's definitely several factors, but for one, it was always like China was, you know, they're like, all right, we can't feed this many mouths. We can
well, absolutely right. And then they were trying to raise the standard of living, which easy when there's fewer people and there's
But the thing is with China is like, not only did that one child policy backfire like crazy on them, but it's also now they have a rapidly aging population. If you look at the average age of the population, I don't know what it's at right now. I forgot what you said earlier, but it's super high. Workforce participation is declining. Their general overall population is declining super fast, and they have a net immigration. That's immigration with an E, so net outflow by a lot, and they have no automation. So just kind of comparing.
Yeah, it's 300,000 to 400,000 people a year do leave China.
Right. So like,
it's kind of this net immigration number that I was seeing.
Yeah. So if anybody can't afford to have a declining population, it's China, because they're already experiencing a bunch of people leaving China. In that figure, that 300,000 to 400,000 per year range, that's how many people are leaving China every single year. They have a rapidly aging population. And we talked about this, like Peter Zeihan, I forget what
he's an author and an analyst. Yeah,
he's a geopolitical analyst or something like that. But like he, you know, and he's super smart. I mean, this guy's been doing this geopolitical thing for
about 20 years now.
Yeah, he's been doing it forever. So smart guy. He says this is the beginning of the end for China. China's probably got about 10 years left. I don't know about that.
I think that's a little fast.
I agree.
But you used a really fun phrase earlier. You said the doom loop.
The doom.
And this really is kind of one of those, like the beginning of, I think, a doom cycle. Mm-hmm. So for those of you that don't know, a doom loop is when you have something bad happens, A is bad, which leads to B. B either reinforces the badness of A, or it leads to C, and C reinforces the badness of A.
Or both.
Right? So, or it leads to D, but eventually it creates a circle where it's bad, 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 back to the original bad, reinforcing that bad, and so it comes straight back down the same tunnel.
Yeah, so just kind of like a high level, like think about 2007, 2008, that the great financial crisis, the doom loop was, you know, the ratings agencies, the insurance agencies, you know,
when they would downgrade a mortgage-backed security, and then you'd have a bank sitting here holding that security going, now my liquidity's in question, so I have to sell it.
But even before that, that's another tough thing about the doom loop is like, we don't know really when it starts, right? Because it could have started when these ratings agencies were like, all right, we trust in your tranche, because the ratings agencies didn't do any due diligence when it came to
very little due diligence. Yeah, it's true.
Exactly. In terms of like, okay, how are you tranching these mortgage-backed securities, right? Like, because like, I mean, if you know how tranching, like in terms of mortgage securities or any sort of collateralized loan or collateralized debt obligation,
tranching is a really slice of something.
Yeah. So tranching is a really tricky strategy, and it really like a lot of companies, SPVs that do the tranching. I mean, they can really finagle the figures to make it look like this is a much more appealing strategy. They can do tranches within tranches to get a better credit rating across the entire debt obligation, right?
So, or they, as Anthony Bourdain would say, is they could take a bunch of things that didn't sell, mix them together into an entirely new thing and sell them.
There we go.
Now it's diversified.
Now it's technically diversified. Now it's a seafood stew, right? And the best part about it is that they don't know that they're eating 3-day-old halibut, right? So
being the morally onerous chef that I am.
I love that. Anthony Bourdain, literally, man, what a hero. I love Anthony Bourdain so much. Man, that was...
Pour one out.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, seriously. Cheers to that one, dude.
Which, folks, is the only time you'll ever hear me say it's okay to pour out some alcohol.
When you talk about Anthony Bourdain.
To memorial to a friend or honored colleague.
Yes, 100%. Kind of yeah, exactly. So. Pour one out.
So I guess in memoriam. That's China's problem. So demographically, oh hell, Leonard Skinner's last original living member died last night.
That was pretty sad too.
That was wild.
On the bright side, it's David Gilmour's birthday today. So
hey, you know, let's look up.
Yeah, let's look up.
But no, so that's exactly China's problem. China's problem is that they have a declining population. They have a large solo male population. In fact, I can tell you that in the current, based on 2020's numbers, which I imagine will have changed ever so slightly given the reopening and the getting rid of zero COVID and letting people die.
Oof.
Yeah. As of 2021, I guess this is actually where my head was coming from. In the under 4 category, there were 3.4 million solo males, right? So there were 3.4 million more boys than girls in that age bracket.
Under 4 years old.
Under four.
Wow.
Now that is now this assumption, now it takes two to tango.
It literally does. If you really think about it.
Most critically, it takes one woman to produce one baby
every nine months.
Or rather, I like to think of this as one a year.
Yeah,
for,
that's,
you know,
much more practical.
Health,
yes,
and safety.
No, 100%. Yeah. I mean, I feel really insensitive
agree that just thinking about it in that sense, it is callous. But when you're thinking about an upper limit, the upper limit of the number of children to be born a year is the number of women who are capable of bearing a child in that year.
Yeah, in terms of growth, yeah.
Yes. And so, like, when we're doing just pure numbers, it's, like, there's a bunch of other things that need to go into this.
Yes.
But yeah. so just with that, so there's, but in that 0 to 4 population, there are 32,768,000 girls that are under that are 4 and younger.
So in terms of the Doom Loop, because obviously I think one of the big problems with the Doom Loop, I think one of the big things that started the Doom Loop for China, I think problem A starts with President Xi. Feel free to disagree with me.
Problem A starts with a one child policy. And then problem B is that people realize that boys support their family, and that when a girl marries, she joins his family, and it's now up to her, the men in her family, family she was born into, it's up to the men in that family to take care of that family. So it's very much there is a transactional nature to marriage in China still.
Right. But I think, honestly, I think part of how this all started, you know, and I think President Xi, I personally don't think he wants to know what's happening with the Chinese population. Because if he did,
I think he'd rather not believe it either. Yeah.
Exactly. Because I mean, if you know anything about President Xi, and like Peter Zion talks about this a lot, right? And this is the thing, is if you don't know I don't really know that much about China. So what I do is I listen to people that do know a lot about what's going on in China, like Peter Zion.
And absolutely. I'm not saying one should always listen to more interested parties.
Yeah.
That being said, one should also attempt to understand what are the interests of those interested parties, right? So like, oh, this guy who really knows a lot about China or is researching a lot about China, what's his interest in all this? Oh, it's this, this, and this. Okay, so grain of salt on A, B, and C, but the rest, those are actually useful facts.
Right, exactly. So this is
especially with us, if you hear facts that you disagree, if you hear something that we say that you disagree with, call us out.
Yeah,
and
seriously,
we'll either defend it or we'll... Or you're right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But that's the thing with Peter Zion is just like, so I don't want to just like hear everything he says and go like, okay, he's absolutely right. I want to look into it, right? Because I don't, you know, I like his perspective. That's why I listen to him. And
absolutely.
A lot of times he is correct, right? A lot of times I fact checked him.
When I hear a perspective that I really like, or I'm like, oh, I really like what you're saying, I then have to go and read, because I'm like,
exactly.
Maybe you're just telling me what I want to hear.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, maybe I'm President Xi-ing myself.
But no, so my fun demographics about China is that at present, the population of China that's under the age of 15, so 14 and younger, has been about 17%, and it's stuck there for about a decade.
And that's, I'm assuming, with one, fudge numbers, but two, okay, so let's assume that's plateaued, and let's just also—
Well, more importantly for the decade, so for 1 year out of this decade, the population has declined, but for 9 years out of this decade, the population has increased, but the percentage of the population that is under 15 has stayed percentile static, approximately.
So okay, on average, so it stayed that's static. A little bit,
what
that's
that
a
means
more promising
is that,
then. Yeah.
which as a identifier, as something we can draw our information from, means that if 17% of my population is always under the age of 15, my population is increasing. What that means is, and yeah, a percentage will, 17% of 100 is better than is smaller than 70% of 1,000. But if the percentage doesn't change, but my elderly percentage is increasing, it's getting much, much bigger.
Then that's
eventually
not
we
a good
have
sound.
To look at this idea that is that, and especially here's put this way, the last 2 to 3 years, there have been more deaths than births. So there's been a negative growth rate. And
The percentage of male female
and then more than that, the under 15 remains at that 17% margin. It tells me that, well, there are fewer children. It suggests to me that, okay, people aren't having as many kids. There is not a replacement rate.
So that one child and policy really stuck with them, huh?
Has stuck. And more than that is you then have people who were raised in the one child policy, and then they go to get married and they go to have a child or children, and then they decide, well, actually, our quality of life is blank.
Good point.
One child is quite expensive. Mm-hmm. Two child is very expensive. Or two children are very expensive.
And then they take a vacation. Yeah, they take a vacation to Thailand or to Taiwan. And they're like, wow, it's so nice.
They go on
here.
Vacation.
Oh man,
geez. Maybe I'll come back and just
stay forever.
Royal on the beach.
You have a cousin, or maybe I made a friend or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, no. But what I was gonna say is actually more than that is if we want to know where I'm looking, the real doom cycle, the real doom loop is in China. It's actually it's declining demographics and an overinvestment in bankrupt real estate.
Yeah, well, I think the real estate thing was really just a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, absolutely.
Because if you're going to buy all this, it's like the opposite of Blackstone, BlackRock. BlackRock is buying all the real estate in America, whereas I don't know which power or who is buying up all the real estate in China. But that just doesn't make any sense if there's a declining population. Whomever is buying the real estate.
Real estate loses value, right?
It makes no sense.
Oh, there's 900 million apartments. So how many people are there? 700 million. Well, 200 million apartments do not have people. So why would I give you money for it? Well, because it was worth this.
It doesn't matter. What am I going to do? Buy it to sell it? If you're a real estate investor, that's really not what you want
to
do.
To whom?
So
which immigrant is going to
exactly
come buy this?
Exactly. So yeah. So that's. I mean, the doom loop with China is. I think is very present, and I think a lot of it has to do.
In it. I think they're in it. And the real.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah, that's what I meant.
In order to counter
a
doom loop, as we've consistently seen, so like in the U.S., there was that big doom loop in 2008, which was
the mortgage-backed securities
were crashing. The mortgage-backed securities were crashing, and so banks were selling them. Were selling off mortgage-backed securities in order to create liquidity. Because banks have liquidity obligations, they have to maintain a certain.
They have
liquidity.
Reserve requirements, yes,
yeah. Exactly. And so when all of them are selling off MBS to maintain liquidity, it devalues everything they're holding.
Not to mention, if they get downgraded, that also creates a further devaluation.
And thus they're selling
the
more
record,
to create liquidity.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So doom loop.
And so
in 2008 we saw. The only savior you can possibly get when you're in a doom loop, which is to say an external solution, an external savior coming in and going, that point was TARP, going, this is what we're going to do. And TARP was a great, was a fantastic government program.
Yeah. I mean,
necessarily for the people, but
for the government, which was
a whole,
which was very manipulated, which was very, very much manipulated by a continuation of lowering which dovish behavior, right?
I mean, well, yeah, it didn't. That made certain things better, but I'd like to think that they
made a lot of things better.
I should like to think they were not holding hands, the Fed and everything else, quite as much as they probably were.
You know,
at the time,
I'll be honest
with
you.
Certainly, after 2012, I don't think they were.
You know, I'll be honest with you, right? So it's been 3 years since we've been doing this. It's been 3 years since I've been paying attention to all this stuff. Am I? Mm-hmm. 3 years of experience.
More than that. You've been paying attention for more than three.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. So thanks for giving me that extra credit. But in my extra years of experience, I'm beginning to be a little bit more skeptical. I really think that they're like, no, yeah, just buy all these bonds. Yeah. We'll lower rates. We'll roll these off our balance sheet.
Well,
yeah. No, yeah. Totally. Look,
I'll be honest. I'm not. Maybe it's because I've paid attention for longer.
Okay.
I don't think the government is quite that competent. Let's put it that way. I don't think the government is competent enough to pull off that kind of activity.
You know what? I will accept that reasoning.
Do they pull it off? Yeah, absolutely. Is it deliberately done because they're trying to? No, it's beneficial, it's coincidental.
Well, okay, exactly. So this is the thing. I feel like if you go up to an average congressman or a congresswoman, or if you go up to an average senator, and just ask them, what happens if the Fed lowers interest rates? What happens to bond prices? They're going to be like, oh, well, that means, you know, bond prices go up. They're going to know that happens. But I guarantee
I'm not so convinced.
I think they do. But I think if you ask them why, they will come up with
Well, at least on the House. Okay. Senate, I believe. Okay, maybe. But yeah, the House, absolutely
no,
not.
I think they know the correlation, but they don't understand why the correlation is the way it is.
They certainly don't understand. I agree with you there.
Okay, cool. And maybe you're right. Maybe they have no idea.
I'm willing to believe the Senate might be able to give you an answer and be 51-49 correct. And I'm not willing to believe the House would be even remotely close to correct on what would happen.
I want to do that. I wanted to give the Senate a quiz and be like, what happens to bond prices?
Okay, so I live in Nebraska now. You live in Arizona. That's four senators and even fewer Congress. No, and exactly the same number of Congress people. No, slightly more than that. should we take a Drunkenomics tour of D.C. and just go and 100%. And go hope for the best and just be like, hey, we run a podcast. We're just trying to do
it. Honestly, this is the thing is I don't care if I agree with you or disagree with you. If you're a senator and you want to come on Drunkenomics, come on anytime.
Absolutely. I don't care. I'll be honest, I do not care. If you're a member of the House, I am willing to extend the same invitation.
100%.
Having said that, you will have to defend yourself.
No, 100%.
On your votes and your views.
No, I don't care if I agree with you or disagree with you. I would love to hear your opinion and your perspective. And I'm not going to oppose you. I'm just going to ask you questions. Right? Fair enough. I just want to be honest
about what you're going to walk into.
For sure. My questions might sound like opposition. I'll say that. They probably will because I usually ask pretty critical questions. I like to think I do at least.
My thing is I don't think ours be opposite. We might oppose someone in their views and in their position, but we'd be like, well, how do you, as intelligent and educated economists, we would say, well, okay, so that tends to lead to this. How do you intend to address this issue? Or what do you guys think about inflation? These are answers that you should have an answer for.
You gotta be ready for that.
In a position where you can affect the thing.
Yeah, exactly. But speaking of which, I will, if they do come on, if any senators come on, if any congressmen, congresswomen come on, I will 100% be willing to give them a nice Drunkenomics sweatshirt as a thank you for coming on and taking on the questions.
Absolutely.
Speaking of which, where can they find this nice little Drunkenomics sweatshirt that...
You can actually find this pretty sweet swag at drunkenomics.myspreadshop.com, and that is one of the coolest websites I've ever been to.
It really is.
I'm not currently wearing my Drunkenomics hoodie.
Oh, neither am I.
That's because I am...
Let me put it on real quick.
Off my base, it's a little warm right now. I would say at this point, I have seen Aaron without sleeves for over an hour, folks.
Sorry about that.
I don't know that we have a sleeveless Drunkenomics, but I'm gonna say we should.
We got tank tops,
bro.
Oh,
is that a? Wait a minute. Hang on, Aaron. What hoodie is that?
Look at this,
Aaron. Aaron in an original Drunkenomics hoodie.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that in months.
Doesn't this look
That's
great?
A good one.
I know, I love it so much. It's my favorite hoodie ever.
Nah.
I love this hoodie so much, I'm scared to wear it. That's why I don't wear it that often.
If I spill coffee
on this thing, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so scared. Yeah.
That's why I wear my my Drunkenomics hoodie. I have my Drunkenomics hoodie. I have two, but there's my Drunkenomics hoodie, my gray one that I wear to place to the Treasury, my Feds. I have my location hoodie, and then I have my I have another hoodie that I just wear for comfort, warmth, and the fact that it's nice and soft. But more importantly, my plan is all the Fed banks and
beware.
A picture in front of all the Fed banks and the Treasury, and obviously Fed headquarters by the time Drunkenomics is 10 years old.
100%. Yeah, exactly. And if you want to help make that happen, you can always go to Patreon, patreon.com/Drunkenomics, drunkenomics. You can get our less gracious host in front of all of those
You can help me fund my extravagant traveling lifestyle of what's it going to take to fly or bus into the next Fed bank.
But yeah, if you want to help James get in front of all those central banks,
not just with a bullhorn outside, telling them how to do their job right, but an invitation in so I could tell them how to do their job right.
Yeah, exactly. You can help feed the geese at patreon.com/Drunkenomics. And from there, seriously, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you all.
Absolutely. 3 years in.
3 years. It's been great. So with that said, I encourage you to please continue to fill and kill. Play chestnut checkers. Don't brag, just say. And what's that last thing?
Stay Drunkenomical, guys.
That's it. Cheers, my friend.
Cheers.